This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون فلا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
this hour, Iraq's national security advisor says that his country does not need any foreign combat troops on its soil as Washington and Baghdad engage in strategic dialogue. Tensions escalate between the U.S. and China as Washington slams China's retaliatory sanctions against a group of American officials. And Muslim activists have been found on the list of British citizens hacked by foreign regimes as a scandal surrounding an Israeli spyware deepens. We'll have a report from London. Well, welcome from our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. A top Iraqi official has reiterated that his country does not need U.S. combat troops on its soil anymore. National Security Advisor Qasem al-Araji said that Baghdad has communicated its stance over the issue to Washington. The comment came ahead of a meeting between senior Iraqi and American officials in Washington on Monday, where they are expected to issue a statement on possible exit of U.S. combat troops by the end of the year. Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi and Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein have also underlined that Washington needs to pull out its forces from the Arab country. In January 2020, Iraq's parliament issued a resolution demanding the expulsion of American forces. That followed the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandas. Beijing has slapped sanctions on several U.S. individuals in response to Washington's bans on Chinese officials in Hong Kong. Among those targeted is former U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. China's retaliatory sanctions follow a recent U.S. warning to companies about the risks of doing business in Hong Kong. Beijing has slammed the U.S. sanctions against Chinese officials in Hong Kong as illegal and a serious violation of international law. Reacting to the sanctions, the White House said that Washington is undeterred by China's actions.
These actions are the latest examples of how Beijing punishes private citizens, companies, and civil society organizations as a way to send political signals and further illustrate the PRC's deteriorating investment climate and rising political risk. These actions would follow March.
Jen Psaki described Beijing's sanctions as outrageous, claiming that the U.S. officials targeted only promoted democracy and human rights around the world. She described China's move as a sign of its further isolation from the world. Venezuela says that a U.S. military plane violated its airspace, pledging to respond forcefully to any maneuver that it deems as an act of aggression. Venezuela's defense ministry said that a U.S. Type C-17 heavy military transport aircraft crossed into the country's airspace along the border with Colombia. It described the violation as a flagrant provocation that took place during a joint military exercise between the U.S. and Colombia. Venezuela does not have diplomatic relations with the U.S. and Colombia, a country with which it shares a porous border of more than 2,200 kilometers. The hacking scandal surrounding Israeli spyware Pegasus is deepening. UK Muslim activists from prominent organizations have been on a list of some 400 British citizens hacked by foreign regimes. Rob Carter has spoken with one of those victims. He believes Israel's regional ally, the UAE, has been spying on him over criticism of their human rights abuses.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula Odin, and Anas al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus. Yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates?
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
Israeli forces have stormed a village north of the West Bank city of Ramallah, killing a Palestinian teenager. The Palestinian Health Ministry said that 17-year-old Mohammed Munir al-Tamimi succumbed to gunshot wounds to his abdomen. Israeli forces also injured over 300 Palestinians during a protest against illegal settlements in the town of Beita near Nablus. They fired tear gas to disperse the protesters and targeted them with live rounds and rubber bullets. Palestinians were demonstrating against Israeli aggression and the confiscation of their land. Palestinians have vowed to continue the protests until they take back their land. The Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is under the sway of the U.S. and seeks to confiscate all the remaining Palestinian land.
This Bennett, he's of course American, like all of the worst Israelis, the most really rabid militant Zionists are American. And Netanyahu grew up in the States, too, with his American accent. So this Bennett, he came in 67. And that of course, was when Jews really were electrified, that they took over all of Palestine. And that was a great incentive. So this was the beginning of the American, the huge American migration to Israel. There are 60,000 Americans in the settlement. 60,000. And Bennett, of course, loves them because he that's why he came to Israel. He came to Israel to get rid of Palestinians, to take over all. He has a one-state solution, but his one-state solution is genocide. He wants to just basically get rid of the Palestinians. So that's his one state. And it's a Jewish state, a one Jewish state for all of Palestine. That's Bennett's credentials. So I was very skeptical when he was elected, and it's really shaping up to be a nightmare beyond belief right now.
Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan has been the scene of protests over water shortage triggered by an unprecedented drought in decades. The crisis has dealt a blow to agriculture and livestock farming. Yusuf Jalali reports from the affected areas.
Every day, Inas gets on this boat with her younger siblings to help their family with herding their water buffaloes. To them, it's an everyday hobby to play with what they call black monsters, a hobby that is about to turn to ashes. Their bulky playmates are now dying of thirst in an unprecedented drought that has devastated the buffalo's habitat.
Every day we lose two or three of our buffaloes and sheep because there is no water, and this water over there is sour and polluted and is toxic to the animals.
This has been the case for thousands of residents in Iran's province of Khuzestan, who have for the past days been protesting over what they call mismanagement of water resources. Khuzestan is inhabited predominantly by Iranian Arab tribes who live on agriculture and animal farming, which have now been devastated by the worst drought in half a century. Heads of tribes have over the past days been acting as mediators between the protesters and authorities, asking the demonstrators to calm down while urging officials to solve the problems.
We lost our farms and livestock in the drought. We need our rivers and marshlands to be filled with water for our businesses to be up and running again.
Every day the scale of the disaster grows and we are paying the price. Our demand is legitimate. The authorities need to do something before an irreversible catastrophe takes place.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, stepped in and called on authorities to speed up their efforts to tackle the crisis. Over the past week, delegations from the government and other entities have been visiting the affected areas to review the situation. In one of its latest measures, the government opened the valves of Karkheh and Dez dams, which have partly filled the riverbeds.
Water is starting to trickle into the riverbeds, raising hopes that life will once again return to the dried land. However, residents here say the crisis is far from over, and authorities need to find a permanent solution to the issue. Yusuf Jalali from the outskirts of Bostan in the province of Khuzestan.
Iran has stressed the need for establishing sustainable peace in southern Caucasus as sporadic border clashes continue between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh urged both Baku and Yerevan to show restraint and to settle their border issues through peaceful means. He also said that Iran is ready to help the two neighbors reach a sustainable peace. Comments came after new clashes erupted between Azeri and Armenian troops along their shared borders on Friday. An Azeri soldier was killed and three Armenian troops were wounded. This is the latest brawl between the countries since a war over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region last year, which claimed about 6,500 lives. The six-week war ended in November with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Olympics opening ceremony officially kicked off the Tokyo 2020 Games, which were delayed for a year due to the pandemic. Athletes paraded in a near-empty stadium as spectators were banned from all Olympic Tokyo venues. That comes against the backdrop of growing popular opposition in Japan against the Games.
The long-awaited Olympic Games officially kicked off in Tokyo on Friday after a one-year postponement due to the coronavirus pandemic. The opening ceremony took place with no spectators in attendance and a reduced number of athletes joining the parade. Only fewer than 1,000 VIPs and officials were present at the Tokyo's National Stadium. The International Olympic Committee has banned foreign and domestic spectators for the first time in the history of the Olympic Games. Meanwhile, athletes, support staff and media are subject to strict COVID-19 protocols. Most world leaders decided not to participate in the event. Also, top sponsors have stayed away, highlighting strong opposition to holding the event in COVID-fatigued Japan. Tokyo is battling a surge in coronavirus infections and is under emergency measures. Daily cases in Tokyo are currently at their highest in 6 months. The Japanese capital logged nearly 2,000 new daily infections before the official opening ceremony. Japanese officials have vowed to hold safe and secure games despite the lingering pandemic. However, a largely unvaccinated Japanese public is worried that the global gathering of 11,000 athletes could trigger a super spreader event. Earlier this week, the chief of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee said they are not ruling out canceling the games as more athletes pulled out after testing positive for COVID-19. So far, over 100 people linked to the games have tested positive for the virus. A survey by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper says around 70% of Japanese people believe that Olympic organizers are not able to contain coronavirus infections. For weeks, there have been calls for the already postponed games to be cancelled amid the rise of COVID-19 cases in Tokyo and elsewhere across the world. Hundreds of people gathered outside Tokyo's National Stadium ahead of the Olympic opening ceremony, while others demonstrated near the Tokyo government building to demand the cancellation of the event. However, the International Olympic Committee has rejected the idea of calling off the event. The committee could lose billions of dollars in broadcast rights if the games were cancelled. That could be a blatant example of choosing money over people's lives.
Australia's New South Wales has reported its biggest daily rise in coronavirus infections amid a weeks-long lockdown.
The not-so-good news is that, unfortunately, the cases continue to rise in New South Wales and here in Greater Sydney. To 8 p.m. last night, we had 163 locally acquired cases.
The surge in cases prompted authorities to declare a national emergency in Australia's most populous state. New South Wales has broken records for daily caseloads in recent days, despite strict lockdown measures in place since late June. The Delta variant has been largely blamed for the spike. The restrictions have now reached other states, sparking anger among the people. On Saturday, anti-lockdown protesters gathered in cities of Sydney and Melbourne. Several people were arrested after violent clashes with police. Around half of Australia's 25 million populations are now in a lockdown across several cities. Brazil has registered nearly 109,000 coronavirus cases in the span of 24 hours. The Brazilian Health Ministry has also registered more than 1,300 new daily deaths. The South American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the U.S. The administration of President Jair Bolsonaro has been under fire over its handling of the outbreak in Brazil, as well as corruption allegations involving the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. In the U.S. state of Florida, firefighters have officially called off their search for more human remains at the site of a condominium tower that collapsed last month, killing 97 people. The Miami-Dade County Fire and Rescue Department announced in a statement the end of its mission after nearly 1 month. This is one person still remains unaccounted for. The Miami mayor said the police department will now continue to reach or search the pile of debris for both human remains and personal items. The 12-story building caved in on June 24th. No survivors could be pulled alive from the ruins since the first few hours after the incident. The cause of the collapse remains under investigation. The focus is on a 2018 report that had warned about major structural damage to the 40-year-old complex. The UN says Africa was the hardest-hit region by terrorism in the first half of 2021. In a report, UN experts have blamed the growing influence of Daesh and al-Qaeda terrorist groups for the violence. According to the report, affiliates of both groups in parts of Africa boast growing capabilities in fundraising and weapons, including the use of drones. The UN's panel of experts highlighted that several of Daesh affiliates are operating in Central and West Africa, while a number of al-Qaeda affiliates are in Somalia and the Sahel region. The experts voice concern over the growing influence of these terror cells across the region. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
More than 600,000 people in the United States have died so far due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the worst death toll in the world, and Republican strategists have warned that the party may be blamed by its voters if this total keeps climbing with further COVID outbreaks. We now present you an article written by Oliver Millman. The piece is titled, Republican Governor Says Time to Start Blaming Unvaccinated for Rising Cases. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Republican governor of Alabama has said it is time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks for rising cases of COVID-19 amid concern that months of misinformation over the need and efficacy of vaccines is fueling a resurgence of coronavirus infections in several U.S. states. Kay Ivey said that vaccines are the greatest weapon we have to fight COVID, and added that a surge in new cases of the coronavirus in Alabama is due to a reluctance among many people in the state to get inoculated. Only about a third of eligible people in Alabama have got a vaccine shot, one of the lowest rates in the United States. The Alabama governor, Kay Ivey, said, folks are supposed to have common sense, adding, but it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the vaccinated folks. It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down. KIV added that nearly all the new hospitalizations and deaths due to COVID-19 are unvaccinated people. She said, these folks are choosing a horrible lifestyle of self-inflicted pain. The criticism of those who are eligible to be vaccinated and have chosen not to get the vaccine shot, despite vaccines being available, follows a concerted effort among conspiracy theorists and others on social media and conservative media outlets such as Fox News to sow baseless doubt about the safety or need for vaccinations, despite a slew of evidence over their ability to shield people from the worst effects of the coronavirus, including death. Some of these falsehoods have been embraced by elected Republicans, while other senior party members have refused to actively endorse the uptake of vaccines, citing personal choice. Others, such as the Senate Minority Leader and Kentucky Republican Mitch McConnell, have stated their support for vaccinations all along, though in an understated way and without publicly calling out more boisterous voices seeking to sow doubt. But in Alabama and neighboring Mississippi, reluctance to take the vaccine can be driven by economic factors, as well as politics or simple fear of a new vaccine. But also for many black residents, they struggle to overcome a historical mistrust of the government and the health system because of a history not just of neglect, but of racist medical abuse, such as the decades-long government-sponsored Tuskegee study, where African-American men were coerced into a syphilis experiment. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey's comments recently came as it has emerged that more than 9 out of 10 COVID deaths in the United States are now people who haven't been vaccinated. Nonetheless, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, just 56.2% of eligible Americans have received at least one vaccine dose. Overall, according to an AP-NORC opinion poll, only 51% of Republicans said in mid-June that they had received at least one vaccine dose versus 83% of Democrats. But in recent days, some leading conservatives have started to call for vaccinations following a surge in infections in several states. In Florida, the Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, recently pointed to data showing that vast majority of hospitalized COVID-19 patients hadn't received vaccine shots. Ron DeSantis, who recently began selling campaign merchandise mocking face masks and medical experts such as Dr. Anthony Fauci, the leading public health official in the United States and advisor to U.S. President, admitted these vaccines are actually saving lives. The White House, meanwhile, is trying to supposedly push high rates of vaccination, said that it is beginning to see a slight rise in uptake in some states, such as Arkansas, Florida, Louisiana, Missouri, and Nevada, where COVID cases are soaring. One doctor in Birmingham, Alabama, has told of how patients dying with COVID have pleaded to be vaccinated, despite it then being too late to do so. The uptick in infections has inundated some hospitals in southern United States, leading to increasing calls for people to take the available vaccine shots. John Bel Edwards, the governor of Louisiana, said on a New Orleans radio show, "The fourth surge is real, and the numbers are quite frightening at the moment." John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, added, "There's no doubt that we're going in the wrong direction, and we're going there in a hurry." More than 600,000 people in the United States have died so far due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the the worst death toll in the world, and Republican strategists have warned that the party may be blamed by its voters if this total keeps climbing with further COVID outbreaks. The GOP pollster Frank Luntz said, "I think they've finally realized that if their people aren't vaccinated, they're going to get sick, and if their people aren't vaccinated, they're going to get blamed for COVID outbreaks in the future." But polling of those who are unvaccinated has shown that many have made up their minds not to get the jabs.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Weight of Chains. Part 5.
Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic reigned over what was left of Yugoslavia as it fell apart in the 1990s. Surviving crippling UN sanctions, wars in Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, violent Albanian separatism in Kosovo, NATO airstrikes against his country, an ICTY war crimes indictment, and 40 years of marriage with a control freak wife, Milosevic was definitely a force to be reckoned with.
Having won the Cold War, And that led, of course, to the breakup of the Soviet Empire, both in the Warsaw Pact and Eastern European countries and within the Soviet Union itself. That has helped contribute to a movement toward democracy.
Former Yugoslavia had an excellent educational system. I'm product of that system, so most of the people from those years, my colleagues, are all over the world and they're extremely successful. However, what happened after 2001, they simply assumed that whatever was suggested by European Union, they have to implement it regardless of consequences.
I don't think West is enslaving us. I think West is liberating us. International Monetary Fund is liberating us. Accepting the terms of the International Monetary Fund are a step forward for Serbia.
The IMF serves the IMF. It doesn't serve any country. The IMF comes in like a vulture. It puts Serbia deeper into debt. That's what it'll do. So the people will be working for the international financial bankers.
This shocked many in international financial institutions and Western corridors of power. Sadly, Dinčić's plan was cut short. Zoran Dinčić was assassinated in March of 2003, and though a Serbian court convicted former paramilitary leader Milorad Ulemeklegija for the murder, the political background behind the assassination was never revealed. The next chosen prime minister, Vojislav Koštunica, continued Serbia's path towards integrations with the West, but he too at one point began to think that he could reduce Serbia's debt and get away with it.
In 2007, at one point, Serbia was in the process of lowering its level of debt.
The Croatian president adores the EU, and that's because joining the EU made Croatia better. I'm sure the intellectuals agree. In a situation where the biggest local shoe companies had formed a cluster called Koštana, slowly reviving the glory days of the old company, here was Dinčić bringing in a foreign company, the Italian Geox, to compete with local companies. Fair enough, one might say. Some healthy competition couldn't hurt. The problem was that unlike the local companies, which received around $2,800 per worker from SIEPA, Geox received over $12,400 per worker from SIEPA. This allowed Geox to snatch up many workers from the local companies which were doing good business, and with them, snatched up the profits as well and took them to Italy. This is Liljana Georgievska from UNIT, an organization that dealt with workers who lost their jobs because their companies went bankrupt following Macedonia's mismanaged privatization process. Macedonia, a former Yugoslav republic, unlike their counterparts in Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, and Montenegro, didn't experience wars or sanctions in the 1990s. The only armed conflict it experienced was in 2001, when Albanian separatists attempted a repeat of the Kosovo scenario. The Macedonians reacted, NATO stopped the Macedonian offensive, and a ceasefire was agreed upon, with Albanians getting many privileges but not allowed to secede. Dozens were killed in the conflicts, and it didn't affect the economy much. Oh, and the country had a very, very low suicide rate. And yet, more and more people were killing themselves in various ways. If you had money, you could buy health. To a certain extent, of course. Most public hospitals were plunged into a severely dysfunctional state, with a very small budget for equipment, supplies, and staff, and with many doctors asking for or accepting bribes to perform even the simplest of medical procedures. For operations that couldn't be performed domestically, patients or their parents were forced to look for donations, while the rich treated themselves to private hospitals and trips to hospitals abroad. One Serbian health minister, Tomica Milosavljević, from Mlađan Dinkić's party, actually went for an operation in Germany himself. Really sends the right message in terms of the people trusting their own healthcare system. Yes, it was a new age. In Serbia, after the fall of Milosevic, the largest opposition party was the Serbian Radical Party. Its leader, Vojislav Šešelj, was locked up by the Hague Tribunal, accused of inducing war crimes through hate speech. This made his party an easy target for the parties that took power after Milosevic. All that the Democrats had to do was to remind everyone that if the radicals took power, we'd all have a replay of the 1990s. And it was working. Until the two main leaders under Vojislav Šešelj, Tomislav Nikolić and Aleksandar Vučić, abandoned the Radical Party. They formed the Serbian Progressive Party and switched their tune from a pro-Greater Serbia stance to a more Western-friendly stance. Suddenly, it became obvious that their voters weren't so much interested in waging war against Serbia's neighbors as they were fed up with the way the post-Milosevic leaders ran the state. the progressives won the 2012 elections, forming a ruling coalition with the Socialist Party of Serbia, the party Milosevic had founded. It was revenge for October 5th, 2000. But did anything essentially change? The new economic and finance minister was a familiar character, Mlađan Dinkić. The difference was that the Western so-called foreign investments seemed to have been left in the shadow of a new foreign investor, the United Arab Emirates. After early elections were called in March of 2014, the Serbian Progressive Party won an absolute majority in parliament. Though Mlađan Dinkić was replaced before the election, this time he was definitely out. Was it finally a change of course? The earliest steps of this new government suggested more of the same economic policies that the Democrats imposed after the fall of Milosevic, but with a more aggressive stance. This time, the new Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić openly called it shock therapy. He filled his government with neoliberal so-called experts, which was quickly praised by much of the media. And the belief in democracy was not really shared by Serbians anymore. In the 2014 elections, Serbia witnessed the lowest voter turnout in its history. Did this mean that the people had lost faith in change through elections?
Well, is there a reason to vote? My own view is, yeah, there's a reason to vote, minor reason. That should take you about 5 minutes to pay attention to it, but the real thing that has to be done is to change the circumstances under which any person in office is going to have to make decisions.
To many, there seemed to be no light at the end of the tunnel. As a matter of fact, the light was closer than they thought. U.S. domination of world economic affairs was a reality after the end of the Cold War. But something different happened in 2010. The G20 held a summit in the South Korean capital of Seoul. U.S. presidents had little trouble enforcing their will on others regarding how the world economy should function in the past. But this time, Barack Obama got the cold shoulder. A new agreement was made, the Seoul Development Consensus, which had done away with many aspects of neoliberalism and allowed a larger role for state intervention. Instead of propagating a one-for-all solution imposed on everyone, it postulated that individual developing nations should shape their own economic reforms and policies. The Washington Consensus was officially dead. A multipolar world was rising again, with a group called BRICS, an association of the emerging national economies of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, challenging the West.
Well, all those countries are obviously countries that at this moment seem to be having a very prosperous future in this changing economic circumstances. And, you know, reaching out to them and trying to establish close cooperation with these countries is in every nation's interest, including Serbia.
But what the mainstream media had done was to condition many people in Serbia to hop when they, for example, hear the word Russia and dismissively repeat how the Russians supported Serbia only because of Russia's own interests.
I had many discussions in this regard when a lot of people were telling me, well, but Russia was supporting you because of their own interest, you know? And I said, yes, maybe this is the case. People tend to support other people for the sake of their own interests. But unlike Russia, others were attacking us because of their interest, whilst Russia was supporting us because of their interest. And in that case, I'd rather have someone supporting us for the sake of their own interest than attacking us. And I think it's logical.
Logical indeed. However, the big Western corporations and neoliberal elites weren't ready to give up without a fight.
Propaganda doesn't come marked saying, I'm propaganda. You have to figure out what it is. And in fact, anything that's coming from official sources is very likely to be designed to influence or control minds. And anything that comes from elite circles more or less reflects official doctrine.
Awareness comes through education. Change comes through action. But to change things for the better, you need that first step. Many would think that this is impossible, that the Western powers simply wouldn't allow it. But a revolution against neoliberalism happened recently in Europe. The mainstream media just didn't tell you much about it. 5 years of a pure neoliberal regime in Iceland, a country of 320,000 inhabitants, made it the richest in the world. All of the three state banks were privatized in 2003 and borrowed over $120 billion over 5 years, 10 times the size of Iceland's economy. They created a bubble and everything seemed to be marvelous. But in 2008, Iceland saw its bubble burst. The stock market plunged 90% while unemployment tripled in 6 months. The country's economy collapsed. Iceland needed to restore order, and they decided to find their own way to fix things. Many criticized them for deciding not to follow the neoliberal doctrine, but as Forbes magazine later wrote, Iceland's heavily criticized method to escape veritable economic demise actually did the trick. Forbes also wrote, instead of bailing out banks USA style, the country forgave mortgage debt for the population and completely started over from square one. See, instead of allowing the neoliberal elites and bankers that destroyed the country's economy to get away with it, Iceland actually thought that it might be a cool idea to indict bankers who committed serious financial crimes which made the collapse possible. The government nationalized the banks, paid off loans for consumers, forgave homeowner debt, and threw the offenders in prison. Simply said, Iceland said no to neoliberalism.
We didn't follow the traditional prevailing orthodoxies of the Western world in the last 30 years. We introduced currency controls, we let the banks fail, we provided support for the poor, we didn't introduce austerity measures of the scale you're seeing here in Europe.
And Iceland bounced back, with its economy quickly growing faster than both the US and European economies. Change isn't impossible. In fact, it's absolutely necessary, not only in the former Yugoslavia, but in countries worldwide. The 2008 financial crisis showed that neoliberalism was a surefire way to instability, vast inequality, and disaster. But for change to be effective, it has to have a course. And I believe that course can be summed up in three crucial measures. Protect your local economy. This means getting rid of neoliberalism. Capitalism should work for the national economy, and this means protecting local industry from subsidized imports, even if it means being criticized by the EU, IMF, the US, and other rich countries. What also needs to be done is to limit foreign investments, while investing in the domestic industry and supporting it, as this is what every country which is rich today did when it was growing and becoming rich. For example, in the 19th century, the United States strictly regulated foreign investment in banking, shipping, mining, and logging, while Japan and Korea severely restricted foreign investment in manufacturing. In Finland, between the 1930s and 1980s, companies with more than 20% foreign ownership were officially classified as dangerous companies. Today, Singapore is also used as an example of a successful economy. But despite its free market image, it has one of the largest public enterprise sectors in the world, producing around 30% of the national income. Public enterprises were also crucial in France, Austria, Norway, and Taiwan. In most Balkan countries, there are many public companies that are losing money and serve as job providers for political party members. But instead of privatizing them, the government should invest in making them profitable for the betterment of society, engaging professional managers to run them for the benefit of the community. Even if it takes time to do so, investing in yourself will always prove beneficial. Create a functioning welfare state. Neoliberalism would want you to think that if someone isn't successful, it's not because the system doesn't work, but it's because that person isn't dedicated and hardworking enough. Though working hard is important, even billionaire Warren Buffett, the most successful investor of the 20th century, admitted that society was responsible for a very significant percentage of what he earned.
If you stick me down in the middle of Bangladesh or Peru or someplace, you'll find out how much, you know, this talent is going to produce in the wrong kind of soil, and, you know, I will be struggling 30 years later.
Nobel Prize-winning economist and social scientist Herbert Simon estimated that social capital is responsible for at least 90% of what people earn in wealthy societies like those of the United States or Northwestern Europe. And by social capital, Simon meant not only natural resources, but more important, the technology and organizational skills in the community and the presence of good government. This also means providing for those who are less fortunate than others, and in doing so, creating a society where welfare, education, and healthcare will provide a more productive environment and higher living standard. If the system is established to keep hardworking people impoverished, it simply has to be changed in the interest of the people. As renowned economist Ha Jun Chang said, a well-designed welfare state can actually encourage people to take chances with their jobs and be more, not less, open to changes. Make protesting a way of life. When you ask an average Serbian what protesting against Milosevic in the 1990s did, odds are he or she will say nothing. In fact, as we all know, the protests eventually did topple Milosevic. So, protesting does work, whether it's through going out on the street, civil disobedience, or public awareness campaigns, if organized well and done with enough conviction. However, if you want a society that continues going forward, changing something once won't do the trick. I'm sorry to say so. Life is a constant struggle, and the prosperous countries are those which have citizens who always try to improve the system. A new generation was rising, one that wasn't tired of protesting in the 1990s, one that was internet savvy and could see their countries and the world through many different perspectives. While the internet was still free, they could express themselves and connect with others. Even though social networks pacified many, some used their advantages to gather momentum. The youth was realizing that governments make decisions in favor of the people only when in fear of the public reaction. A new wave had to form, a loud, strong, and unstoppable wave of change. And to be a part of it, there were only three simple things you had to do. Revolt, network, resist.
The Limelight.
For more than a decade, rich nations, those responsible for the vast majority of emissions causing the climate crisis, have failed to deliver the promised $100 billion a year to support countries in the global south in cutting greenhouse gas emissions and adapting to the intensifying impacts of the crisis. We have prepared for you an article written by Kate Blagojevich. The piece is titled, COP26 will be most important summit ever, but the UK's leadership is already falling short. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Summer alone has seen scorching heat domes smother parts of the United States and Canada with record temperatures and blistering heat waves sweep across Pakistan. Torrential rain has caused devastating floods in China as well as in India, Germany, Belgium and Austria. And while fires are raging in Siberia, Madagascar is experiencing the world's first famine caused solely by the climate crisis. Even in the United Kingdom, the first extreme heat warnings were issued in recent days. New extreme weather events linked to the climate crisis have become rolling news. Their destruction and death toll are a daily reminder that the UK hosted COP26. This autumn isn't just the most important climate conference ever held, but the most important international summit of all time. With the world scientific community warning us that we have just 8 years to implement the necessary measures to avoid the most catastrophic impacts of irreversible runaway climate breakdown, failed talks are not an option. There are just 100 days until the summit begins in Glasgow, Scotland, but there's a lot to do and a long way to go if the United Kingdom is going to make it a success. Every country must bring forward targets and tangible policies for the next decade that will cut global greenhouse gas emissions enough to keep alive the goal of the Paris Climate Accord, limiting global temperature rises to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. This requires careful diplomacy, inspired leadership, and an example set for others to follow. So much of the summit's success hinges on the credibility of the United Kingdom's presidency when the negotiations get tough, credibility that depends on action and not words. British government claims to be a world leader on climate action.